Hello, my name is Aida Abghaffar. I'm a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Foreign Policy Program, an adjunct professor at Georgetown University's campus here in Qatar. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this webinar, virtually hosted by the Center for Middle East Policy at Brookings. Europe has had economic, political, and strategic relations with the Gulf Cooperation Council since it was established in 1981. More than four decades later, and despite showing early promise, a host of domestic, regional, and international factors have relegated the GCC to the periphery of the European Union's foreign policy. From the GCC's side, its relationship with the EU was also never a priority. This is due to the lack of internal cohesion between Gulf states, as we've seen from the Gulf crisis, and also the prioritization of relations with other actors such as the US and increasingly China, as well as bureaucratic inefficiencies in the organization itself. What we have seen is that Gulf countries and European countries have bypassed these multilateral mechanisms and instead opted to deepen their engagement and relations at a bilateral level. Is it possible to revitalize EU-GCC relations? What are the obstacles and what are the areas of most promise? How can Europe play a larger role in supporting the GCC countries' development plans and the transition to a post-oil economy? What role can Europe play in the security architecture of the region, and what are the limitations of such a role? To answer some of these questions, Silvia Colombo from the International Affairs Institute in Rome and myself have edited a volume published by Palgrave late last year titled The European Union and the Gulf Cooperation Council Towards a New Path. This volume brought a number of experts to discuss many of these issues. And today we are very lucky to have two of these experts where we'll expand in this webinar and discuss many of these questions. I would like to first introduce our speakers. Courtney Freer is a postdoc fellow at Emory College and a non-resident fellow at Brookings. Omar El-Obaideli is the director of research at Bahrain Center for Strategic International and Energy Studies and an affiliated associate professor at George Mason University. And my friend and colleague and co-editor Silvia Colombo is a senior fellow at International Affairs Institute in Rome. I would like to welcome you all. Starting with Silvia, then Courtney, then Omar, each speaker will have introductory comments for about 7 minutes or so. Then we will open for discussion and questions from the audience. Please send your questions via the Zoom function in the chat function in Zoom, as well as using the hashtag EUGCC on Twitter, as well as sending an email to events@brookings.edu. We've already received a number of questions and we encourage you to send more. Silvia, I'll start with you, please. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Adel, and good morning, good afternoon, everyone. Many thanks to the Center for Middle East Policy at Brookings for hosting this event. Many thanks to the participants, the speakers, for their insights, also in view of the book that we worked together during 2021. It's a pleasure to present some of these insights and also to continue the discussion on a topic that is definitely unfolding, and there are news every day. As Adel said, and as we thoroughly discuss in the book, multilateral relations between the European Union on the one hand and the Gulf Cooperation Council countries, or the Gulf more broadly, have failed so far. There are a number of reasons for that that we explore in the book, ranging from the fact that bilateralism has trumpeted multilateral engagement, with the national agendas taking precedence over multilateral cooperation. The second aspect that we analyze is the fact that up until at least the first decade of the 2000s, this agenda has been of cooperation has been mostly overtaken or concentrated on economic and financial issues, while little attention was given to political, people-to-people engagement or security cooperation. Finally, there is also the point of with whom Europe has engaged with in the Gulf, which goes, as in many other types of relations, with the fact that the US mostly engaged at the authorities level, and has neglected the engagement with the society, broadly speaking. This has created gaps in the cooperation and a long history of failure, low-key cooperation, and growing mutual distrust, I would say. Yet, as we have heard in recent months, there have been announcements coming out from Brussels that a new era of engagement with the GCC is opening up. You might recall that in early October, top diplomats from Brussels, including the High Representative Joseph Borrell, visited three countries in the GCC, trying really to unleash a new path for cooperation. However, I would say that these, again, has raised many expectations, but these expectations have not been met with concrete outcomes. One of the major points that we need to take into account is the need to consider the broad environment and how the history of cooperation between the EU and the GCC needs really to be put in the context of broader geopolitical issues. I will focus in my comments mostly on the security aspect and the security side of cooperation, knowing that my fellow panelists will delve on other dimensions of the relationship. Talking about security, it's clear that the Gulf, broadly speaking, represents a dilemma for the EU, and any cooperation with the Gulf is actually perceived more as a risk than as an opportunity. Why is it that? First of all, as I said, that there are many stumbling blocks in the way in which the relation between Europe and the Gulf has been constructed in the past few years, and in particular the multilateral relations between the EU and the GCC. There are internal problems in the way in which the EU functions when it comes to foreign and security policy. And third aspect, which is very important in my view, is the fact that the Gulf security dynamics do not immediately translate into threats for the EU and the EU member states. Hence, the EU does not consider the region as strategically important. It does so rhetorically, but it does not ultimately behave as if the region were strategically important, contrary to other more proximate and challenges within regions, such as North Africa, the Sahel, or Israel-Palestine, for that matter. Yet we know that if we take the global picture, the Gulf is indeed important in security terms, also for the EU. And there are a number of reasons for that. First of all, many of the security challenges that we see in the Gulf are actually anchored in global dynamics of competition for resources. Take the issue of energy dynamics and shifting balances of power in the way energy is traded, consumed, and so on and so forth. And also shifting balances of power and global threats, such as the non-proliferation issue. So all these are present when it comes to the Gulf, and the EU is well aware of that. Second, the Gulf has become, in the past decade or even more, the center of gravity of the Middle East and North Africa regional security dynamics. This was not the case when the EU developed its relations to the MENA, which tended to exclude the Gulf, i.e. the European neighborhood during the 1990s and the early 2000s. But now, speaking from at least since 2011, the Gulf has taken a center stage in these security dynamics that extend a much broader region that it's very close and very important for the EU, being its neighborhood. If we take the example of the conflicts that are still ongoing or in a freezing mode in this region, from Syria, Libya to the Eastern Mediterranean, indeed, these conflicts do have their own specific dynamics, but they are also in one way or another tied, entangled with Gulf influences and interferences. Last but not least, Gulf security represents a test for the EU common foreign security policy. And again, take the example of the Yemeni conflict and the real catastrophe that has happened in Yemen. And this shows very well what happens when Gulf countries decided to go alone. They have different policies vis-a-vis Yemen, but also when individual European member states follow these Gulf kind of individual policies. And the EU also offers its backing. Given these challenges and the fact that in one way or another, the Gulf remains central to security dynamics, I think it's important to acknowledge also that in 2021, regional circumstances and regional trends have started to shift, and there have been openings of dialogue and mediation that we have seen also happening in the Gulf. And the EU has the potential now to contribute better to security in the Gulf by acknowledging what it can do or what it shouldn't do at the same time, and by first and foremost having clear priorities and recognizing that it can only nurture and support these windows of opportunities that are endogenous to the region. Three aspects need to be taken into account when doing that. First is the aspect of the cooperation with the US, which I think Courtney will shed more light on, how the triangulation between the EU, Washington, and the Gulf is currently moving, and whether there is room for the EU and the US to work together on security issues in the Gulf, knowing that this has been for long and it remains a domain in US hands. Second aspect is that EU can offer a contribution in terms of security dynamics in the Gulf, because it has a broader, tends to have a broader understanding of security beyond purely our security threats or matters. In this sense, economy, climate change, energy diversification, locally tailored approaches are all aspects that the EU can leverage, because it has these are key as key policies in its toolkit. Third aspect that needs to be taken into account when looking for a new entry points for the EU to engage in security with the Gulf, is the fact that quick fixes or short-term solutions will not work, as we have seen in the case of the of restoring the JCPOA or keeping the JCPOA alive. This is a process that has been going on, and the EU should continue to engage with a long-term perspective, because this is the only way to really unlock gradually the potential of cooperation with the Gulf. Of course, a number of areas could be explored to do that in concrete terms. I would say that there are two that hold the most potential, given the fact that multilateral cooperation is blocked on many fronts. The first aspect is, of course, the aspect of nuclear safety and non-proliferation, which goes in the line of keeping the JCPOA alive, but also working also and being prepared to move forward, even in case the JCPOA is not will not be there in the next few months and years. And the second aspect that the EU is quite prepared to do is really to exploit its maritime strategy, which already exists, and to kind of expand it and use it as a launching pad to undertake actions and, in maritime security, knowing that it has already a mission, the MSO mission in place, since 2020, and that many member states are contributing to that. So one way it would be to really multilateralize this mission, which is already really been appropriated in one way or another by Brussels, in order to infuse into that all the knowledge and experience of the EU in this domain, and also to make better use of the approaches of the member states. I will stop here, and I'll be happy to continue the conversation and I'll take questions. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Silvia. Courtney?
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here. Great to see you all. So my chapter in the volume examines the nature and extent of intra-legislative ties between the EU and various GCC parliaments and elected consultative bodies. And I think that this is an area of cooperation that's often overlooked in favor of focus on higher profile trade and security relationships. And certainly those ties are important, especially as we've seen in the past few months a rise in bilateral arms sales from various European countries to the Gulf. Nonetheless, I think it's important to highlight certain delegations from the European Parliament that have conducted for years official visits with legislatures in Bahrain, Kuwait, and Oman, as well as with the Shura Council in Saudi Arabia, in addition to having more informal visits with Qatar's previously unelected Shura Council and the partially elected Federal National Council of the UAE. I see the development of these ties as an important means of creating cross-border cooperation, highlighting legislative best practices, and enhancing knowledge about current events across two very different but increasingly interconnected regions. So the GCC, as you probably know, hosts a variety of political systems, ranging from the more participatory Kuwaiti environment to the more authoritarian Saudi system. Due to these variations, the European Parliament has negotiated different relationships with each member state and with their associated elected bodies. And so we see, again, bilateralism reigning. And this is one of the themes of the volume, and I think one of the themes that we find when we look at EU-Gulf relations in general. In terms of bilateral ties, I think it's worth pointing out where the EU has delegation offices in the GCC. So there are two offices initially in Saudi Arabia and in the UAE. And as of 2019, the EU opened a new delegation office in Kuwait in an effort to expand its presence across the Middle East. And I think this is also notable because Kuwait was neutral during the GCC crisis, which was ongoing in 2019 when this office was established. But I think the fact that the EU does have three delegation offices in three of the six GCC states indicates that there is a desire to continue engagement and to continue this engagement at the ground level, which I think is really important. And regarding particularly the relationship with Kuwait, one area of cooperation we've seen between the EU and Kuwait is on reconstruction of Iraq. The conference in 2018, which Kuwait hosted to kind of raise funds to help with reconstruction in Iraq, was something that the EU was quite involved in as well. And so this is one area where we've seen bilateralism, which could potentially turn into multilateralism because there is a desire for regional security and stability kind of everywhere. The largest obstacle to greater multilateral ties on the political level at the time I wrote the chapter was, of course, the GCC crisis, because this was ongoing. And of course, it's very difficult to have multilateral cooperation when the multilateral body is divided. Even in the existing environment, we're about a year out from the Alula Agreement, which ended the GCC crisis. And I think perhaps in light of some shared challenges throughout the region due to the pandemic, I think some areas for potential multilateral cooperation, especially in the intra-parliamentary field, are emerging. These include discussion both across the GCC and with members of European Parliament about means of implementing austerity measures while protecting society's most vulnerable members. Cooperation could also advance in efforts to nationalize workforces in a sustainable way, as well as to care for migrant worker populations, which seem to be particularly at risk. I think another area of potential cooperation is making progress towards the European Green Deal and GCC states' goals, with very ambitious goals that they've set to reduce carbon emissions. And I think overall, multilateral initiatives on these largely apolitical issues, more economic issues that are critical still to legislators and to legislators, may represent a really important opportunity for collaboration. We could also see potential cross-border, humanitarian efforts in places like Yemen and Syria, where there's still disagreement politically, but there is still a need in terms of the humanitarian side. In terms of bilateral ties, they seem to be most harmed in those countries where European Parliament delegations have at certain times been critical of human rights abuses. And in the chapter, I detail this in the Bahraini and Saudi Arabian cases in the past. In such states, we've seen engagement with elected officials rather than merely with the unelected political leadership, I think would be particularly useful in getting a more nuanced views of these countries and the challenges facing them. Indeed, people ask all the time, what is public opinion like in Saudi Arabia? And I think in that sense, it would be really helpful to have more engagement with, Shura Council members, with other people on the ground in Saudi. And in the past, when the EU and the European Parliament in particular has been critical of human rights abuses, this has stymied some cooperation between on the bilateral level. But I think overall, the European Parliament is uniquely placed to enhance ties beyond ruling elites. And indeed, as long as its members are provided access inside the countries in question, which they have been to now, they should make an effort to expand links beyond the leadership of elected bodies so that broader issues linked to human rights, economic well-being, and even foreign policy can be approached with a greater understanding informed by broader-based discussions rather than just discussions at the top level. And I think in places where if access does become blocked or where criticism is disregarded, there's also an opportunity for engagement with diaspora populations across Europe, and that could also potentially help inform European Parliament's relations with both parliaments and leaderships across the region. But I think overall, trying to deepen relationships beyond just the top level political officials would be useful, and focusing on kind of more economic multilateral initiatives could be helpful. So I'll stop there, and we can pick up a lot of other issues in the Q&A.
Thank you very much, Courtney and Sylvia, for giving us the contours of the relationship and its political dimensions. I think this is a perfect time to get Omar in on the conversation to speak about the economic side of things and the economic relationship and how it has developed or has not developed. Please go ahead.
Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to contribute today. And I very much appreciated listening to Sylvia and to Courtney. In terms of the economics, so I would say the EU used to have a clear policy when it came to its economic expansion. You have to bear in mind that the EU, especially after enlargement, is a huge economy. And so it doesn't, you know, it gets most of what it wants internally in terms of its trade. It doesn't need to pursue trade relationships for economic purposes in the same way that the GCC might have to, or a small country would, like Singapore. And so this has allowed it to use its trade policy historically as a tool to advance ostensibly non-economic goals. For example, it wants to promote multilateralism. It wants to promote, as Courtney mentioned, human and worker rights. It wants to protect the environment or promote the protection of the environment. That was an important theme of relations or negotiations, for example, with the GCC throughout the 90s and early 2000s. But to be honest, the EU now seems to be paralyzed. So Sylvia gave a perspective as an EU citizen living in the EU. I'll give a perspective as somebody looking at the EU from the outside. To be honest, it doesn't seem to be able to sort itself out internally. You know, it's got problems with Hungary, Poland, and various other countries. It can't seem to sort out its energy problems. I mean, I would almost describe it as embarrassing what happened this winter with the energy shortages. And it can't even sort out its issues with, you know, Russia, Ukraine, NATO. I mean, it's just sitting by like a deer in the headlights with what's going on in Ukraine at the moment. And I see absolutely no decisive action, no formal stance. The US is doing the only pushback that is being articulated to, you know, against Russia regarding Ukraine seems to be coming from the US. And I have no idea what the EU is hoping to achieve. I don't even know if the EU knows itself what it wants to achieve, to be frank. I don't have the expertise to analyze the reasons why the EU doesn't even seem to be able to get out of its own way. The implications, nominally speaking, are not good in terms of getting a deal with the GCC, the long-awaited FTA. First of all, such sort of negotiations would have a low priority because, as I say, the EU doesn't seem to be able to get out of its own way at the moment, and it can't even solve the pressing issues domestically or on its borders, let alone, you know, trying to do something with the GCC, which is quite far away. They can't agree on anything internally, it would seem, and they don't even know what they want individually, even setting aside the coordination problem. I don't even think the individual member states have a clear sense of what they want from the GCC, to be honest. I get the, you know, we've had in Bahrain, you know, as a researcher working in a think tank, we've had contact with the EU. I've sensed an impetus from the EU to Courtney mentioned the increase in the number of missions and they want people on the ground. And as someone living in the GCC, I have sensed what she's describing, but I also get the sense that it's more bureaucratically driven than it is politically driven. I get the sense that the people in the, you know, the bureaucrats who work in the diplomatic entities and the high office and all its high commission and all its organs and so on and so forth, they have worked out that, you know, let's try and do something, let's pick up the ball, let's keep things rolling. But I don't get anything from the high heads of state from the European Council. I just see disinterest or preoccupation. Now, I would like to say preoccupation, but the problem is I don't even see them doing particularly well in tackling the other problems. So I'm really not sure. There seems to be a paralysis in the EU. It's very sad because as a GCC citizen who very much cherishes GCC integration, GCC integration is supposed to be, you know, significantly easier than EU integration because we are much more homogenous culturally, linguistically, religiously, economically than the EU. And so we've always looked to the EU. People like me who are in favor of integration have always looked to the EU as an example. And to be honest, what the EU has done in the last, you know, 75 years is genuinely remarkable. And I always am amazed at how, you know, when you read about, you know, the state that Europe was in 1945 and how far they've come and just, you know, just avoiding. You know, when I've been to Brussels recently and just before COVID, and it was the first time I'd been, you know, since I think 2000, I really felt a sense, I don't know how representative, but I said a sense of an EU identity, a European, I think the EU and the European Commission had successfully created some sense of a European identity. But so that's why it's sad to see things you know, not going that way anymore of late. Hopefully it's something transient. Now, in terms of the GCC side, the GCC still broadly has the same goals as before, which is, you know, and these are mentioned on the security side. And Sylvia was right that the EU, the GCC side have always wanted, you know, external security. But, you know, the US has been providing that for a while. Now, in principle, they should want that even more from the EU. But what I will say is that there's an accentuated economic need for access to a large market. So whereas, you know, in 2008 or 2009, I think is when the GCC unilaterally broke off negotiations with the EU regarding an FTA, oil prices were high. And that, you know, the economic diversification was like, yeah, it'd be nice if we diversified, but, you know, it was no big deal because oil was about, I think, $90 or $100 per barrel and heading on the way up to 120, which would be the peak a couple of days later. So really there wasn't any compelling reason to pursue access to the lucrative EU 500 million person market. But now it's completely different, you know, for reasons clear to everyone in the audience. Oil prices are lower, you know, pressure, economic pressures are much higher. So there's a huge carrot. And, you know, these GCC countries are trying to diversify their exports in particular, and the opportunity to sink their teeth into, you know, EU consumers is certainly attractive. There's also an accentuated need for diplomatic support post-US withdrawal from the Middle East. I say diplomatic, not security, because I don't see the EU exporting any sort of security assistance, but they can help diplomatically for sure. You know, when you look at a country like Iran, I imagine that what's in the case, the GCC country's mind is, look, we can't contain Iran militaristically, but let's try to contain it diplomatically. And the EU does seem to have some leverage over Iran diplomatically. So they would like to use that to the greatest extent possible. And one goal that's still important is the EU as a knowledge and an innovation partner. You know, many people in the Gulf go to study in university in the EU, and the top EU companies, you know, the companies like Siemens, and they continue to play an important role in the GCC economies and potential sources of knowledge transfer and partnerships. Now, there are two reasons for optimism in terms of things, you know, improving. And this may explain, as I say, some of the things that Courtney mentioned and that I'm sensing in terms of the impetus on the ground. The first is energy, okay? And that's even before, you know, this absurd crisis that's been happening over the last few months, which is that you know, the GCC grid, the Gulf countries have had a grid and a very well-functioning grid, and it's slowly integrating with the EU. It's sort of piecewise process. It goes GCC, Jordan, I think, Egypt, Libya, Morocco, or Tunisia, Morocco, and then up across Gibraltar. And then in principle, it could go around the other way through Lebanon. But if that happens, then, you know, this is a triumph for you know, for Immanuel Kant and John Stuart Mill and other sort of leading lights of the Enlightenment, because this is an example of the classical liberal case for peace and diplomatic integration on the back of economic integration. If these countries, you know, if you just very briefly, climatically, there's a great opportunities for trade between the EU and the GCC energy-wise, because the Europeans use electricity is when we don't use it, just now. My electricity bill is like a low level, whereas Sylvia's is probably very high. And then in summer, mine is super high and hers is super low. So it would be great for us to trade and not have to build up lots of excess capacity. And secondly, and this goes back to the issue of the crisis mentioned by both Sylvia and Courtney, the GCC, the Qatar crisis, there's a credibility element, which is the GCC Interconnection Authority, the grid that they've been using to trade energy within the GCC, was actually fully functional and very professionally done throughout the Qatar crisis. So it did not disrupt, and that gives credibility. Whereas at the moment you're seeing with Russia and Ukraine and all these sort of political, the GCC, despite their political internal difficulties, have managed to depoliticize in the energy market. And that's probably something which is extra enticing now to the EU, given what's happening in Ukraine and so on and so forth. And then in terms of also solar power, so it doesn't show on the map, by the way, but Saudi Arabia is actually half the size of the EU. It doesn't, you know, the distortions that happen when you flatten a globe. It's actually, in terms of land area, half the size of the EU, and Saudi Arabia has a lot of space for solar farms, and the EU is obviously very crowded. So in the EU's long-term renewable energy goals, if they integrate with the GCC, there's great opportunities there. So those are my, and finally, there's increasing, and this is something we'll talk about later, perhaps, which is increasing attention to climate change by Saudi and the UAE in particular. And that could catch the EU's eye, because I think, you know, everyone in the EU now seems to have climate change as a priority, and the EU is always looking for partners, especially because the US, China and Russia seem to be dragging their feet on. I mean, there's a lot of talk in the US, but when it comes to actual action, the EU's far ahead of other regions. And if UAE and Saudi Arabia can even do half of what they are planning to do, that's something that would make them valued partners to the GCC. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Omar. A lot to unpack there. And I'll start with a question that you posed. What does the EU want from the GCC? And you highlighted also internally how the EU has many internal issues. And I saw Sylvia taking some notes there. So perhaps I'll just loop in Sylvia and ask her that question. What does the EU want from the GCC at the multilateral level? But also at a bilateral level, what are the strongest relationships there, and how do these supersede the multilateral mechanisms?
Thank you, Adel, and thanks to Courtney and Omar for great inputs. Well, the question is really direct, but I don't have a similarly straightforward answer. I mean, there is not one single wish that the EU would like to pursue in its engagement with the Gulf, with the GCC. It's clear that there are different agendas. And the second part of your question about what are the strongest bilateral cooperation frameworks, what are the strongest relationships, tells a lot also about what the EU, Europe wants from the GCC, from its engagement with this region. It's clear that if we take France, Germany, but also previously the UK, partially Italy, they do have their own national policies vis-a-vis individual countries in the Gulf, from Iran to Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, UAE and Qatar, all included. But also they have their own vision of the region as a whole, which differs a lot depending on historical relations, differs from a lot in terms of people-to-people connections. For example, to France, it's very important that France's policies towards the Gulf, despite all the appearance of being shaped by business and military-related deals, is actually really very much tied to the presence of people of origin that originate from the Gulf in France, the connections with the Middle East, broadly speaking, and so on and so forth. Again, these different agendas then are kind of translated into the cacophony of the EU as a perception and policies vis-a-vis the Gulf and the GCC. It's really a cacophony because there is not one strategic vision. And as I said at the beginning, there is also a sort of reluctance by the EU to come up with this strategic vision about the Gulf and the GCC, despite all the declarations, the announcements. There is a reluctance in terms of stepping up and taking a major role in dealing with this part of the world, knowing at the same time that these two regions that speak to one another also in terms of, you know, processes of regionalization and regionalism, will go in the direction of having to cooperate more. As Omar said, there are pressures that nowadays put the EU, the European Union, and the European member states on the course of having to cooperate more with the countries in the Gulf, because they are a sort of a gate also to Asia and so on and so forth. At the same time, this strategic vision, this strategic set of priorities is lacking. And I think that it's not enough to compile a list of the national kind of priorities and national agendas to get a sense of what the EU is wants from the Gulf. Of course, the issue of security, as I've tried to articulate, is crucial because of the ramifications that Gulf security has for the broader Middle East and North Africa region and for these global connections. But at the same time, although this is important for the EU, there is still a piecemeal vision about what security and the contribution of the EU to security in the Gulf looks like. I can just spend a couple of words on a specific, for example, role that my country, Italy, played. I mean, the vision, the perception of Italy's contribution to security in the Gulf, or the engagement with the Gulf, is really shaped by domestic priorities. Take the example of the military contracts, the selling of weapons, and the way in which, for example, this has amounted to a sort of competition, intra-European competition against, for example, France and other European countries about who gets the most lucrative deals and so on and so forth. And this, of course, is a clear example of a lack of even national strategic vision about this region. Thanks.
Thanks, Sylvia. And just continuing on the security discussion and looping in Courtney, of course, Europe and the US under the Obama administration worked to put together the JCPOA deal, which President Trump withdrew from. And when President Biden came in, there was initial hopes to put together a new JCPOA, and there are current discussions and negotiations happening now in Vienna. But given that the debacle that happened in the withdrawal from Afghanistan, what is the appetite in the US for an actual reconfiguration from a JCPOA? And actually, how can Europe trust the US again, given that it withdrew from a deal? And how can the Iranians themselves trust a potential and the long-term viability of any future JCPOA deal?
Thanks. This is an excellent question. I mean, I think there is in general an appetite for some type of rearrangement of the deal, but in the US. And I do think this is a major sticking point in terms of guarantees. I mean, how do you ensure that the US doesn't unilaterally withdraw again, for instance, with the next administration? And I think that's one of the major sticking points. I do think that since the Obama administration, there has been this perception in the Gulf that the US is withdrawing from the region. As you mentioned, Afghanistan, I think there's also under when Biden came to office and even in the run up in his campaign, he talked a lot about human rights and democratization. Last month, the Summit for Democracy was hosted and was a very symbolic gesture towards, you know, the US's desire to lead, you know, what it sees as a democratic world. And I think that in that sense, that makes some Gulf leaderships, which are not democracies, nervous about the US appetite for continued engagement in the region. And so I think what we are seeing in the Gulf, and this is vis-a-vis Iran as well, is, you know, increasingly taking things into their own hands. I mean, we saw last month, perhaps the best example, which was the visit of the Emirati National Security Advisor to Tehran. This was the most senior level encounter between Iranian and Emirati officials in a decade. Last year, Saudi Arabia launched a dialogue with Iran in Baghdad, mediated by the Iraqi government. These are ongoing. And so I think we see more and more the desire for the Gulf not to wait for the US to have an appetite to do something, because, you know, we've seen what happens, that the US can and did withdraw from the JCPOA quite suddenly. And so I think that we're seeing more activist foreign policies in the Gulf and more engagement in particular with Iran, trying to deal with Iran kind of on their own terms, not just through the eyes of the US.
Thanks, Courtney. Omar, I'll go to you. I have a question from the audience on the viability of a future EU GCC trade agreement. But I want to take a step back from that and just ask you, post Al-Ula, is economic integration back on the table? How do you see economic integration happening in the GCC? Because the FTA is part of that discussion. Because we also see the Emiratis, for example, moving ahead with negotiating FTAs of their own. We have Oman. We have the various GCC countries sort of having bilateral approaches towards FTA. So I just want to ask you the first question on economic integration, and is it back on track? And the second one on the potential for a free trade agreement.
Yeah, so ironically, the causation is reverse. And throughout the 90s, the EU, when the EU was trying to negotiate with the GCC over economic integration, one of the main demands and points of consternation from the EU side was that the GCC didn't have a customs union. And so get your customs union. So then the GCC countries had to get a customs union first, and then they could properly enter negotiations. And then since that was in 2003, the GCC customs union, and then 2008 was a single market. So ironically, an attempt to secure an FTA with the EU is what has been driving partially GCC economic integration. And that demand from the EU, I imagine, is still there. And look, as I say, when it comes to trade, you know, the trade with the GCC, as is with most blocs, is pretty much irrelevant on the economic side to the EU. So it's up to the EU in terms of what political goals it wants. It doesn't gain or lose much either way by signing an FTA with the GCC. The question is, does it satisfy its political and diplomatic global agenda? And would it be something that, you know, confers benefits to its prestige? I think that the EU is looking for something to do, something it could advertise as a successful. They had the Mercosur, I think it was a couple of years ago, and since then, you know, nothing else is going on. So I think it would be nice, and it would be also a nice way, especially if the Saudi Arabia and UAE make progress.
I think there's something also on EU-China that they've been negotiating that was also...
They've been negotiating EU, but that one, I think that one's going to be more controversial. We'll see where that one ends up. I think they would be, especially if Saudi Arabia and UAE make significant progress on climate change, then I think it would be a nice win for the EU to say, look, they've made good progress on the climate. It doesn't cost us anything to give them a deal, so let's give them a deal. And a precondition for the deal is a soundly functioning internal common market for the GCC. So in that respect, I see, in general, the negotiations promoting further economic integration in the GCC and, you know, being in a virtual cycle. But it all goes back to, you know, the issues that Sylvia and Courtney mentioned earlier and you in your introduction, which is to what extent the highest level diplomats in the EU both at country level and at the EU level, have this, you know, burning desire to get the deal done. If I was in their position, I'd do it. I mean, as I said, what have they got to lose? I mean, it doesn't really make a difference one or the other, so you might as well get the political benefits. I think you'd need a whole, you know, university of political scientists to analyze the EU and how they make their decisions.
Thanks, Omar. You also mentioned the climate change, so I want you to expand on this a bit. This has been a big year on climate action, and there's been lots of plans coming out of the Gulf, some very, very ambitious and perhaps overly ambitious. So I just want you to reflect perhaps on some of these plans and how can the EU potentially play a role in attaining these goals and plans.
So first of all, there's a big internal pressure, ignore external pressure, there's a big internal pressure to develop, you know, renewable energy and to reduce pollution, because the GCC countries, if you're trying to attract foreign direct investment, now there's green investment codes, you know, everywhere in the world. And so if you're trying to attract foreign investment like Saudi Arabia, UAE, and so on and so forth, and you're, you know, producing huge amounts of carbon, then it's not going to jive with investors. So that's incompatible with your economic strategy. And secondly, it's, you know, the desalination requirements. So desalination is highly energy intensive. And if you keep using, you know, gas or oil to power the desalination plants, it's just not economically viable in the long run. So it is just on purely economic grounds, it makes absolute sense for the GCC countries to be transitioning towards renewable energies. And then there's also the political dimension, you know, and diplomatic in terms of, you know, being able to advertise and look how green we are and so on and so forth, which I think is potentially important. But I do think the desalination and economic and desire to attract FDI is the strongest. Now, that doesn't mean to say that they're going to realize their goal. I mean, some of the goals, without naming names, don't seem particularly credible. But to be honest, you know, now, you know, everybody in the world seems to be making incredible claims about what they're going to do in the next few years. So the GCC is hardly in that boat alone. But I do think that the UAE, fundamentally, all of the GCC countries have, it's not just, you know, showmanship or making noise for the sake of catching headlines. I think there are, you know, serious internal requirements. Bahrain is slightly different from the other five because we don't have space in Bahrain. So we can't build, you know, huge solar farms, and our wind is not enough to get wind energy. We don't have any volcanoes or, you know, other sources of energy. But here, the GCC Interconnection Authority is critical to Bahrain's renewable energy goals, because if we invest in a Saudi solar farm and an Emirati solar farm, an Omani one, we can, you know, achieve our renewable energy goals without having to, you know, find an extra, you know, million square kilometers somewhere.
I have another audience question to Sylvia, I think this time. We have a question that looks at interests versus values. And the question is about, is the EU now focusing more on its interests and put away some of its values, diplomacy, not just in the Gulf, but broadly across the Middle East, due to, of course, internal dynamics and regional challenges? Is the EU now more specifically focused on its interests? We see lots of declarations coming from the European Parliament, for example, on human rights issues in the region. But when it comes down to it, there's definitely a sense of realism, especially from this, under this current presidency and foreign policy team. If you can expand on that.
Well, thank you, Adel. This question is it's always asked when it comes to the EU's foreign policy vis-a-vis not just the Gulf, but the MENA region in general, because this mismatch between the pursuing of interests and on the one hand, and on the other, the upholding of values, both internally and externally, is what tarnishes basically the EU's action abroad. It's true to say that again, it's not just specific of the EU's engagement with the Gulf, but it's clear that when it comes to the GCC countries' governments, there is an added layer of complexity, which has to do with the fact that these countries are very attractive in terms of making business and pursuing these interests, mostly private sector related. But on the other hand, there are serious problems when it comes to values, democracy, human rights, and so on and so forth. And going back to the issue of bilateralism, it's clear that, again, for many years, the EU has a sort of found middle ground compromise, even within itself, with the member states, whereby the member states would continue their policies of engagement, irrespective of the human rights violations by some of the GCC countries, while the EU would try, mostly thanks to the role of the European Parliament, as Courtney alluded to speak in the name of protecting values. But it's clear that just speaking about values or saying that there are certain red lines without implementing them, without putting certain conditions, is not enough, has not been enough. I don't think that the EU today has shifted towards more, it's true that it's become pragmatic, has remained highly pragmatic, but there is this twist in pragmatism, which is called the principled pragmatism, as the EU wants to, you know, to project it, in the sense that the pragmatism of the EU when it comes to foreign policy is always sensitive to values and the principles that the EU first and foremost tries to implement internally. I don't think that the EU has been very successful in that, but at least clarifying the fact that there shouldn't be double standards is a first step in this direction. And now it's in the hands of the member states, because we know that most of these issues, when it comes to military deals, when it comes to foreign security policy, are in the hands of the member states. It's really up to them to find a more coherent approach when it comes to these issues. You remember a few years ago, there was a huge spat between Germany and the, Saudi Arabia, or most recently also, you know, what happened between Italy and the UAE when it comes to the selling of military equipment and so on and so forth, because of the lack of respect of human rights, because of the interferences and pressures in a number of conflict situations throughout the Middle East and North Africa. Well, these things have been resolved in one way or another, because there are important pressures coming from the business community in all the countries. But I think that overall, there is a greater awareness of the fact that it's not possible to escape this tension, and there needs to be a firm, coherent line that all the member states try to implement when it comes to dealing with these countries, which doesn't mean putting interests aside, but because they are there and it's not possible to get away with them. But at the same time, even just repeating, reinforcing the message that certain standards, certain values need to be upheld is the right way to go. And in this sense, the role of, again, the parliament, the multilateral institutions within the EU are trying to keep up to this job.
Thanks, Silvia. I think this is also a perfect segue to ask Courtney the same question when it comes to the US, when it comes to interests versus values. We've seen definitely under the Trump administration, there's been prioritization when it comes to the region of definitely US interests, and the Trump administration in particular had very close relations with a number of Gulf capitals. We've seen the Biden administration come in, perhaps initially with some tough rhetoric against Saudi Arabia, but that to some it has been smoothed over, to others it has not. We've also seen relations with another capital, Abu Dhabi, slightly shaky recently in terms of the F-35 deals. I just wanted you to reflect a bit on the new US administration and its relationship with the Gulf capitals as it stands now.
Sure, yeah, it's a great question. And I think that the Biden administration really self-consciously has wanted to distance itself from the Trump administration when it comes to dealing with the Middle East in a transactional way, because that's really kind of how the Trump administration viewed the Middle East. Sold a lot of arms, basically just wanted to make deals. And I think with the Biden administration, certainly in the campaign, we heard Joe Biden, I believe he called Saudi Arabia a pariah state. I mean, he came out with very strong rhetoric in terms of putting values at the forefront of democratic values, basically at the forefront of American foreign policy when it comes to the Gulf. And so when he did come into office, we saw some sanctions of individuals who were thought to be involved in the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, the declassification of certain CIA documents related to Khashoggi's killing, in addition to suspension of support for the war in Yemen. That said, the State Department has approved a $650 million missile sale to Saudi Arabia under the Biden administration. And so the way that this has been justified is that this is defensive uses only. And so this kind of loophole has been used in Congress to justify this arms sale. And so, I think for some people, they think that the Biden administration is backsliding in terms of its rhetoric about democracy. I mean, you have on the one hand, as I mentioned, the Summit for Democracy and this desire for the U.S. to be a leading light when it comes to democratic governance. And on the other hand, you do have continued weapon sales. And also these do make a lot of money for the U.S. economy. And as you mentioned, the sale of F-35s to the UAE is suspended for now. And so we'll kind of see what happens there. I mean, I think we have seen some bilateral weapon sales from EU states to the UAE. I think there is, you know, potentially space for other states to step in here. I do think overall, I mean, the U.S. will not, I think that any ideas of U.S. withdrawal from the region are really overblown. I mean, the U.S. still has massive military bases within the GCC. So the U.S. will not, you know, completely withdraw. I think it may reframe the way that it enters these relationships and may reframe them as kind of the need to defend the region and stabilize it. And I don't think you'll see, you know, as chummy relationships as we saw between the Trump administration and, for instance, Mohammed bin Salman. But at the same time, I think the economic relationship, the security relationship is still, you know, extremely important. At the same time, I do think you're seeing a more, as I mentioned before, a more activist Gulf foreign policy emerging vis-a-vis Iran. Also, in general, the UAE has reached out to Turkey and Syria, as well as to Qatar. So you see these capitals willing to carve things out on their own. And also, they're seeing a desire to and a need to craft some regional security mechanisms if the U.S. you know, is seen as a less reliable partner, which I think there was that concern, certainly when the Biden administration came into office, considering, you know, how much rhetoric there was about, you know, the need to align American interests and values. I do think that rhetoric will likely continue, but in terms of action, I think it's still unclear how much, you know, the U.S. really can change its arrangement towards the GCC, given how much investment is there in terms of the security architecture in particular.
Thanks, Courtney. Question to Omar. As we've seen, like Courtney and Sylvia have highlighted many of the challenges happening in terms of GCC's foreign policy with Europe and the US. There's a new the player, or not a new player, but the player who's exerting more influence in China. So right now, all of the Gulf foreign ministers are actually in China, as well as the head of the GCC in Beijing for meetings. How do you see the relationship with China playing out, and how can China play a bigger role? You know, of course, as Courtney mentioned, that the U.S. remains the main security underwriter, but it definitely, we've seen Chinese footprint grow immensely across the Gulf. So how do you see China playing a bigger role over the future, and can it perhaps one day surpass the U.S. and Europe in the region?
So, I mean, first of all, I'm an economist, this is not my area, but I'll do my best to answer. So I know Courtney mentioned that, you know, as many people do, that there's a huge military footprint still in the GCC. But what do we mean by the US withdrawal? What I mean by US withdrawal is that even though there's these thousands of troops there, they're just not doing anything. And it's, there are plenty of chances to do things, and they just don't do anything. And people's ships are getting attacked. People are invading each other's countries and crossing borders and so on and so forth. And they literally, you know, don't seem to be doing anything. It's almost as if they're there, you know, just for show. I don't know what purpose they're serving. Actually, my sense, and this relates to the other issue which you mentioned in China, my sense is that the only reason the US troops are there is to stop China moving in. Because so much of China's energy comes from the Gulf region, especially if you include Iran and Iraq, you know, in the mix. And so it's like, well, you know, we're a rival of China, so we're not going to let them have security over their, we want to have leverage over their energy. And I think that's the only reason they're there, because I don't really think they're serving any other particularly important purpose as far as US strategic interests are concerned. And they're certainly not maintaining security. I don't see much security activity, apart from what was going on in the Straits of Hormuz, and I think they're doing their joint operations with their little alliance. But that's, you know, that's pretty low scale compared to what they could be doing or what they formerly did. In terms of what role China could play, China doesn't have a significant military footprint anywhere outside. And I don't think it has any interest in as long as it's getting its oil, to hell with the Middle East as far as China is concerned. And again, ironically, the major interest of China in the Middle East is maybe only to gain leverage over the US. But as a region itself, it sees it as a convenient energy supply, a potentially interesting market in terms of somewhere it can sell its goods. But again, in the large scheme of things, places like the EU, places like China, they're huge compared to the GCC. The GCC is just like an economic irrelevance to them beyond the fact that they may supply a strategically important good. So I think that the US and China compete over influence in the Middle East to gain influence and leverage over each other. But in the long run, neither of them is going to be flexing any significant military might there, unless it's on a very specific, very sort of surgical strike to maintain a very specific interest. Otherwise, it's up to the Middle Eastern countries to fend for themselves. And that's, you know, Courtney mentioned that Tahnun went to Tehran a month ago, and there, which would not have happened as recently as 5 years ago.
Very much, Omar. And on that note, we will end this webinar. Thank you very much for joining us. And we expand on many of these issues in our edited volume, which the link is there online. Thank you very much, Sylvia, for joining us. And thank you, Courtney. And thank you, Omar.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to like and subscribe for more videos from Brookings.